So this is what I would like to talk about today, the ways we can measure our progress. And there are different ways, lots of different ways that you can measure your progress. I think it's a good question. I'm sure it's something that comes up in everyone's mind. It's something that's always been an important question for me. You know, how am I progressing, and to be able to find markers and ways of understanding and measuring my progress. And first, I think there's one qualifier that needs to be made, and that's that we shouldn't get too caught up in the idea of progress. There are many senses of the word, or many ways that the word or the concept of progress can be misinterpreted and can be actually harmful to one's state of mind, because one begins to develop expectations and develops self-loathing or guilt feelings for not living up to one's standards. There was an interesting, I had an interesting thought in this regard yesterday or today or sometime recently, because I was recently, I was given an article on Asperger's syndrome, and so I did a little bit of reading about it, and you know, like I think everyone who starts reading about specific labels, no, that we put on specific conditions, you immediately start to look at yourself and to compare the symptoms with your own experience, and in a sort of a hypochondriac sort of way, you begin to think, "Wow, I've got that symptom, and I've got this symptom." And at the same, so I was reading about this, and it struck me that, hey, maybe, you know, this explains some of the problems that I've had in my life. This is a form of autism that it's marked by higher than normal intelligence, but difficulty interacting with other people, difficulty in society, antisocial behavior, or you know, the inability to engage in ordinary social behavior, difficulty with empathy, and so on, among other things, impaired motor activity, and so on. But the point is not in regards to the condition. Actually, what happened then is that in the past week or so, I've been called, I was called antisocial, but in a very negative sort of way, and a sociopath. I was actually called a sociopath. Or, you know, it wasn't a direct insult, but it was like, I don't want to talk with a sociopath. So. And I was thinking about these words, and, you know, the funny thing is, of course, that as Buddhists, or especially as monks, we're not all that keen on being social. It's not really, you know, such a great quality. You know, if someone says, "Wow, you're very social," it's not really a great compliment for a Buddhist meditator. It's kind of something that you think, "Yeah, hey, I'm a little too social here. I should, you know, go back and look inside, spend less time looking outward, more time watching my own feet." Less time watching other people's feet. But you know, when a monk, specifically in this case a monk, calls you antisocial, a fellow Buddhist monk, you start to think, you know, maybe there's something wrong. And then I thought back about this this thing I had read on the internet about this label, you know, the condition, the term, the syndrome it's called, or whatever it's label it's given. And You know, the funny thing is it made me realize how much of a how much of a relief it is, and what a crutch it is, it can be to be able to have a name for your condition. And I thought, yeah, hey, maybe it's just that I'm autistic. And I thought immediately, hey, wow, you know, now people won't have to hate me because I'm antisocial. I can just tell them I'm autistic, and they'll be like, oh, okay, that's okay. In that case, it's no problem. But it's an interesting dilemma then. No, the problem with this, of course, is that it leads us to be. It leads us to be negligent, you know, as a result of identifying with the condition. But anyway, it was something that struck me as relevant to sort of our progress on the path, you know, that we pick up these labels, you know, these ideas of where we're going and who we can become, and we often come to identify with a specific condition. In some cases, it can be a condition that we have, and in other cases, it can be a condition that we don't have. And in the cases where it's a condition that we do have, we very quickly begin to identify with it. And if we have a name for it, even more so, it becomes a part of who we are. And as I was thinking about this, you know, this idea of how it might be very easy to identify with the condition. You know, when a person has cancer, it becomes a part of who they are, and it's always in their mind, this idea that they have cancer. But you know, there's so much more than the cancer. If a person, say, has cancer on their liver, for example, you know, suddenly they become nothing more than this spot on their liver, and that's suddenly this one little part of them is more important, far more important than any other part. And of course, there are reasons there, but the idea is that we can often take things out of proportion, and when we begin to identify with a condition or a state of being, even more so. So when someone calls you antisocial, or in this example, you know, it's very easy to then feel guilty and start to identify with this, you know, and think that somehow you have to change yourself, that you have to become something. That you have to become a different person, you know. When we have a specific condition, you know, a person who is this or that. Anyway, it can be a cause for us to actually give rise to negative mind states. And on the other hand, when we think of who we want to be, what we want to become, we want our mind to be calm, we want our mind to be quiet, we want to be this or that. You know, we begin to identify with something that we're not and feel guilty about the fact that we don't have a particular trait. So, this is all in regards to how we can judge our progress, just that we shouldn't try to judge ourselves. And the idea of progress should really be in terms of mind states. Of course, everything in Buddhism, our whole practice should be in terms of ultimate realities, from moment to moment. So we shouldn't think in terms of I am this, I am that, I'm not this, I'm not that, and take it as some kind of being that exists. We should never think of ourselves in terms of a being. We should always look at the experience. It becomes, you know, much more dynamic, and our practice becomes much more visceral and much more real than this idea that who I want to become. You know, people will often have the idea that they want to become a sotapanna, a stream enterer, when they start to read about these states of being. And it's that's a wonderful thing. I mean, there's certainly it's a great aspiration in a sense, but it can become an obsession where you identify with this desire or this state, the idea that I am not this. And you'll never reach it because there's a dichotomy. There's the I that is not this, and then there is this, the state. And you know, they can never meld because they're separate entities in our mind. You know, the idea of who I am and the idea of an enlightened being. When you begin to, you know, when you break that down and simply look at reality, you know, look at your defilements and so on, and then of course it's a gradual and it's an inevitable process that the mind inevitably releases and lets go without any desire or intention. So just a warning in regards to the idea of how we progress, that our progress should be measured in terms of mind states. And I'm going to try to go through it here. So the first way we can measure our progress is in terms, it's all in terms of those things that I talked about in the beginning. First in regards to our meritorious acts, so the goodness in our hearts. The first one is, are we generous? Are we kind with other people? Are we helpful with other people, to other people? Our family members, you know, when they need something, when they want something, when they need help or assistance or even just kindness, are we able to give it to them? Are we helpful individual? Do we do things in our daily life? Is our way of life kind and helpful and generous? The people that we do interact with, are we selfish towards them, or are we kind and helpful and caring and compassionate? This is the first meritorious quality of mind. And generosity is the positive goodness of an individual. So you can look and see, you know, when you interact with other people, what sort of mind states come up? Do you think to do good things, and do you speak in ways that are beneficial? Are the words that you use kind and caring and helpful and compassionate and so on? Or can you be a bit of a jerk sometimes? So do you sometimes say things that hurt other people and cause suffering and stress for others? Do you act in ways that are beneficial towards others? Do you spend your time working in ways that help only yourself, or when other people need help, do you help them? So this positive side of goodness, is it there in your life? Or do the acts you do generally tend towards your own material wealth and well-being and benefit and so on? Or are you just lazy and not doing anything good for anyone? Number two, are you moral? The negative side of goodness. Are you able to abstain from those things that are a cause for suffering? A cause for suffering for others, and a cause for your own mental distress and guilt and so on. When the opportunity comes up to hurt or to kill animals or other beings, do you refrain? In regards to other people's property, Do you take and leave them without sometimes? Taking the last cookie from the jar? No. No, in this case it means taking other people's belongings. When it's theirs, taking it from them so that they are without, that they are left negative. In regards to friendships and relationships, are you moral? Do you refrain from splitting other people up? Refrain from romantic engagement with people who are already engaged. So when you meet a couple who are happy together, do you think about how you can break them up and take over the relationship? Or are you able to let go of this and be content with the relationship with you that you have, or even more, be content in the in yourself? Be content to be one and to be whole in and of yourself, to be complete, to be a complete person and a refuge for all beings with impartiality. So to be celibate in this sense. Now, where is your level of morality? Do you lie and cheat others, or are you honest? And these can all be measured, relatively speaking. So we can look at the past. Are we better in this sense? Are we more virtuous, more generous? And the third one is our meditation. Are we meditating more? Are we more meditative? When we eat, are we meditative, being aware of the tastes and the sensations and the motions of the mouth, the throat? When we take a shower, are we mindful of the showering, of the washing? We brush our teeth, are we mindful? When we walk, are we mindful? And relatively speaking, are we able to engage in mindfulness more than before, or perhaps less even? Maybe it's still the same. Do we practice more meditation when we do our walking and our sitting? Are we actually aware of the movements? When we move our feet, are we aware of the movement of the foot? Or is our mind off somewhere else? Are we aware this is lifting, this is placing, this is so on? Are we aware of the stomach moving? When the stomach moves, are we aware of it? This is rising, this is falling. Are we aware of feelings? Are we aware of our thoughts? Are we able to see things clearly, more clearly than before? These three are considered to be merit or goodness. Let's say goodness is a better word. So there are three aspects, basic aspects of goodness, and you can look at them in a relative sense. So are you more endowed with more goodness than before, or less, or the same amount? And hopefully you can see that through your practice that actually you have more of these things. And it's something that we should, at this point in the rainy season, and also at this point in our lives, look at and try to adjust and to develop more of these qualities: generosity, morality, and meditation, or mental development. This is one way. Another way of measuring our progress is in terms of our training of the mind. It's quite similar, actually, but it's a different layout. Not talking in terms of goodness now, but talking in terms of training. And in Buddhism, we recognize three trainings: the training in morality, the training in concentration, and the training in wisdom. So where are we in this respect? Well, morality we've already talked about, but on a moment-to-moment level, in terms of the meditation, are we able to refrain from the bad no intentions of the mind, when the intention to do bad things or to say bad things, or even when the intention to become distracted arises? Are we able to keep our minds focused, pull our minds back? When our mind does get distracted, when we have greed and anger and delusion, do we find ourselves acting on these? You know, maybe when we have pain, do we find ourselves immediately adjusting because we don't like it? Or when we want something, do we find ourselves immediately getting up and quitting our meditation in order to obtain it? This is in regards to morality. And are we able to pull ourselves back when the mind starts to wander, when defilement arises, you know, when we have anger arise or disliking, when we have wanting arise? Are we able to catch ourselves and pull ourselves back to a clear awareness of the experience? So when we have pain and we get upset by it, are we able to say to ourselves, upset, upset, disliking, disliking, until it becomes just pain again, and we're able to go back to saying pain, pain, and being aware of it just as pain? Or do we find that we instead get carried away, and when the disliking comes, then it becomes upset, and then we're no longer able to sit still, and we have to get up and quit? This is in regards to morality. In regards to concentration, are we able to see things more clearly than before, so that we don't get as angry or as greedy or as deluded as before, so that these things don't even arise? Concentration, or let's say focus, and I've talked about this before, because we don't have to have this strong concentration where our mind is compressed into one little state. Concentration can be or focus can samadhi can simply mean can simply mean a levelness of mind, where the mind is at the right level, it's tuned. So it simply means that you see things clearly without getting upset about them. Are you able to experience reality without getting upset by it? So when you have pain, are you able to see it simply as pain? Whereas before, immediately you would get upset and have to move. When you hear sounds, you know, are you able to simply hear them as sounds? When you see lights and colors and pictures, when you have any sort of experience, are you able to experience it just as it is? This is the focus. Is your focus right? Or are you out of focus and therefore still giving rise to liking and disliking? Because this is really the fine-tuning of our practice. Our meditation practice progresses based on our ability to simply see things as they are, simply experience. When a thought arises that we want this or want that, to be able to see the thought simply for what it is and not give rise to the wanting. When our old habits crop up, that we're able to see them for what they are and not give rise to the emotions of liking and disliking, so that we're able to be happy and at peace with the reality of the experience, that there's no upset in the mind. This is concentration. If we're doing well, we can see, relatively speaking, are we better in this? Are we less angry and less upset than before? Are we less greedy and less addicted than before? If so, then it means we have better focus, better samadhi. And the third one in this category is, as I said, wisdom. So do we find ourselves able to understand things better? It really comes directly from being in focus, because once you're in focus, then you do see things clearer. So not just that our mind is concentrated, but actually that we see things as they are. And we're able to see things arising and ceasing. So whereas before, when something arose, no, when say the roof caves in, right away you get upset. You start to think about all the you know, what to do. You know, the roof caved in. Now I have to get a contractor to come, or I have to. You know, it's going to cost me all this money. Even just thinking about the roof caving in can be a real catastrophe. Just the thought can be a horrible thing. No. If I tell you, be careful that, you know, if I asked you, what would you do if the roof caved in? Just my asking you can in many cases bring up all sorts of stress and suffering. You think about money that you'd have to spend. You think about the rain and speaking of rain, something's in my bathroom. You think of all of the suffering, the damage that might be caused, and so on. Let alone if it actually happened. So when it does happen, or when catastrophes happen, if you get in a car accident, I told this story a long time ago about a woman who actually got in a car accident, and this is an excellent indicator of the arising of wisdom. She was on a bus, and the bus hit a moose. And this is in Canada, and we have meese. And she was thrown out of the bus. I don't know, other people, maybe people died, I don't know. But she was thrown out of the bus and landed flat on her back on a rock, paralyzed, I think, or in great pain. And from what I was told, she found herself just lying there, saying to herself, rising, falling, and just watching her stomach until the ambulance arrived. And the people, the paramedics or the ambulance workers, they were so impressed and shocked. You know, how could she seem so calm, and she wasn't upset at all. I tell this story often about this woman in the airplane that I met, who simply by saying to herself, afraid, afraid, she was able to experience the landing of the plane without any kind of fear or upset. It's the power of seeing things as they are. It's quite simple, and it's too simple, in fact, that people just fail to appreciate it. That was the case with this woman on the airplane. Because she was asking me, she said, what does that do? What good is that? Is that really, what's the point of saying to yourself, afraid, afraid, afraid? It's like stupid, really. It sounds like something silly. And so I said to her, well, we can argue, or I could explain it to you, but the best thing is for you to just try it. This is the great thing about the Buddha's teaching, is that it's truth. It's true, it really is reality. What the Buddha taught, it's very easy to sell if you understand it. If you understand the Buddha's teaching, it's very easy to sell to other people. People are people, and they're very slippery. They're very good at finding reasons not to see things clearly. But you don't have to convince them. You can say, if you want to understand, try for yourself. If they say, I don't want to try, then that's up to them. This is probably the most powerful thing about the Buddha's teaching, is that if you try, you'll see. So I get in all these arguments with people, and you just think, well, it's really quite pointless. We can argue and argue, but if you try, you'll see for yourself. If you look, you'll see. So this is in regards to wisdom. We can ask ourselves, are we able to experience things with more wisdom? Whereas before, if we got thrown out of a bus, now we get thrown out of the bus and land on our back, and we're able to be less upset about it. I have broken bones and so on. When you get bitten by a snake, and you find yourself less worried about dying than before. I was up on a mountain, this far away mountain, and I got bitten by a snake, and I was bitten by a snake, but then it was kind of funny, actually. It's like, wow, what an odd occurrence, right? It's not an everyday occurrence to be bitten by a snake and have your foot starts to swell up and so on. So I found it kind of humorous, actually, and the funniest part was the doctors, and the worst part was the doctors, is that they wanted me to go to the hospital and And they wanted me to wear this. Anyway, I've told that story before, I think. But the point being that, well, you know, there's something good there. Obviously, something good about the meditation, because I assume before I would have been a lot more freaked out about it. Well, maybe not. But you can see that this is one way. This is really the best way that meditation helps us. The ability to see things as they are and to experience the reality around us just for what it is. Okay, so that's set number two. Set number three is specifically in regards to the defilements. So these are really, it's all overlapping, it's all the same thing, but it's just different ways of looking at our progress. So in others, the simplest way of looking at our progress is just looking directly at our level of defilement, the things in our mind that are causing us suffering. Do I have addiction? Do I have more addiction than before, or do I have less addiction than before? And to see whether you're progressing, you can ask yourself this: whether you have less, you're less addicted to the things that you used to be addicted to. Maybe before you were passionate about this or passionate about that, and now when you look at it, you're able to see it more objectively. Now that whereas before it was a cause of great tension, this desire, the tension brought on by desire. And now you're looking at it, and you're able to actually experience it, and to say, okay, now I'm, now I'm seeing something, or now I'm even wanting something, and to just look at the wanting, to look at the seeing, to look at the thinking, when you think about something that you want, to feel the pleasure of that comes often with wanting, and as you look at it clearer, now you can see that it's actually. The tension is reduced, and the great stress that's involved with the desire has been reduced to some extent, and as a result, you have less desire overall. So you find that rather than wanting things, you feel, kind of content and happy with the way things are, the way things are right now. You find that, maybe you want something, but then you look at it and you say, well, yeah, so I want something. And then it disappears, and you're happy again. And so slowly you start to give this up. You find yourself less angry than before. In the same way, really. When something unpleasant comes up, and you look at the unpleasant feeling, you look at the pain and the headache or the unpleasantness, you look at the experience itself, and you feel the tension that's involved in your ordinary way of experiencing it. And so slowly you give it up, and you start to see that actually it's just an experience. So do you have less anger now than before? And number three, do you have less delusion? Now, delusion is a difficult one, though. It's often people often ask, well, I understand greed, I understand anger, but what about delusion? And really, the funny answer is that that's actually part of the point, is that delusion is not understanding, it's the confusion. When you have to ask, what is delusion like? It's a sign that you have some delusion, because there's the confusion. That's one sense, but there are fairly clear signs of delusion that we can recognize. Much of delusion is the non-recognition. So at the moment when you're mindful, there's no delusion. But any other time when you're not mindful, there is the non-recognition. That's a kind of delusion. But a more active and positive form of delusion, positive in the sense of actually being recognizable, actually being an experience, are in terms of conceit, our desire to oppress others, not desire, but the oppressive intentions, putting yourself above others, self-righteousness, when you're angry and then you feel like you deserve to be angry, that another person deserves to suffer, it's good to make people suffer and so on. This delusion, No, the intention to oppress others or oppress yourself. As I said in the beginning, I was trying to explain about our clinging to ideas of who we are. You know, and when we get into a situation, there's these feelings of guilt for not being good enough, or feelings of depression, or our views. Views are a very important part of delusion, and this is the interesting thing I was looking at today, because it seems to me, and could be wrong, but I was having an argument with someone about, I think they're probably still going to fight back. I say something, they say something. It's not exactly a fight, it's an argument. And I said to them, you know, this argument is really, you know, what's the point of this argument? And back and forth. But I said, you know, really we should just go and practice meditation. But the interesting thing about the argument is that I say when I practice meditation, I see something. You know, it becomes clear, something becomes clear to me. Particularly, it becomes clear to me that rebirth, the concept of rebirth, of being born again, or of the mind continuing on, to spell it out exactly, the nature of the mind to continue on after the moment of physical death seems to me clearly evident. Now, for this other person, it wasn't clearly evident. They practice meditation, and in fact, they said they see the same sorts of things and experience the same sorts of things that I claim to experience. And yet they said they still feel like rebirth is just a theory. And to me, from my point of view, this seems to be the case that a view is getting in their way. And why I explain this, why I bring this example up, is to sort of show how views work, because it's possible that you can see something. It may not be the case with this person. They may be right and I may be wrong. So it's I don't want to hold myself up above them. Not in this case. But it can be the case that someone can look and see and still hold on to views. A person could practice meditation, see all sorts of interesting and new things, and still not really get it. You know, be blocked by what we call views. So, for example, if a person has a view of God, that God is our Savior, and it is through the grace of God that one goes to eternal heaven or eternal hell. This view is pernicious. I don't know if pernicious is the right word, but given this view, someone holding on to this view, if it's a pernicious view, it's something that blocks one from seeing the truth. So that actually, even should one practice even intensive meditation, it's quite likely that they won't get to the result or obtain the fruits of the practice. This is also the case with people who desire to become a Buddha, incidentally. That there's a state of mind involved with the desire to not become enlightened that actually prevents one from seeing things clearly as they are. It will stop one from obtaining the results of the practice, which is sort of related to views, but here specifically dealing with views unrelated to reality. If you have the view of self, it's a pernicious one. If people have the view that there is a self, then, well, this is absolutely contrary to what we expect people to see in the meditation. So even though they will see things arising and ceasing, they'll still cling to the idea that there is a self below this. If they cling to that idea, then it'll never hit them that, you know, everything is impermanent. It will never get through their mind, because they always have in their mind the idea This gets in our way. It stops the process of the mind from getting it and from giving up. So this is in regards to delusion, and this is the third group of indicators. Now, do we have less greed, less anger, and less delusion? Or do we in fact have the same amount as before, or do we have more? It's a way of measuring our progress. And I think these three are three very good indicators of our progress. It's important that we understand, as I said in the beginning, that progress is something that should be understood based on mind states, based on individual mind states. So we should never get the idea that we are something, or that we're not something. Another thing that often happens is people get overconfident. They have experienced a state of meditation or even a period of meditation where they don't give rise to a certain mind state that they gave rise to before. So before they would get very angry, and now they find they're very peaceful and calm. Before maybe they were addicted to something, and now they find that they're not addicted to it. And as a result, they think that that experience has disappeared. But a part of taking things mind state after mind state is the realization that the progress in the meditation is very quite gradual, and that in fact what you'll experience is that after a while these states will come back. So maybe before you got very angry about something, now you're not angry, and then suddenly, boom, you get angry again. And it can often be the case that people think, well, you know, that I'm really gaining nothing out of this practice. The same old habits, mind states are arising that I thought I was through with. This is why I caution people against the understanding that concentration is of greatest importance. A concentrated state of mind is actually can be quite deceiving, deceptive. It's possible for someone to enter into a very focused, concentrated state of mind and still not learn anything about reality, and so as a result give rise to the same old mind states again. And this is often what happens in meditation. Part of the results are actually not results, they're just temporary suppression. You're not actually getting anything out of the meditation, it's just a temporary relief, because we tend to repress and suppress rather than experience and understand and let go of. So we shouldn't, on the one hand, we shouldn't get over confident, and we shouldn't mistake the suppression of defilements with actual eradication. But on the other hand, we should look at the relative nature of the mind state. So yes, we get angry about the same things that we got angry about before, but is it really on the same level as before, to the same extent as before? Because generally what you'll find is, yes, the same mind states come back, but no, they're not as strong as they used to be. And I'm actually less attached this time around. It's the same old mind state. You know, I thought I realized that this was useless, and yet here I am going over it again. But it's less. It's lessened. This is the key. This is the reality of our practice. It's not magic. It's not like, poof, gone. Oh, that was a nice trick. It's not a trick. It's a slow, gradual process of changing your understanding, changing your habits based on the understanding, based on a new understanding of reality that doesn't involve partiality, doesn't involve compartmentalizing reality into good, bad, acceptable and unacceptable, and so on. So, that was the talk to give tonight. I've gone probably way over time. I think I've lost a few people here, but we still have 7 viewers. So, I think the next part of our program tonight, which has been a bit of a patched together program. But the upside is now you get to see me. Great. And you get to see my wonderful green room. So next part of the program will be the meditation part. So you're welcome to log out, go home, go back to your room and meditate. You're welcome to go on and do other things if you don't want to meditate with us. But I think now, as a group, for those who are interested, we will do some group meditation. So that's all for the talk.